I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anelio. And you're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast. This is going to be episode number 244.
That is Patrick Hester. He's an author, a blogger, and a Hugo Award-winning podcaster for the SF Signal Podcast. You can check out his website, atfmb.com, and follow him on Twitter at atfmb. My name is John Anelio. I am a musician and a composer and a podcaster. You can check out some of my new instrumental music over at johnanelio.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at johnanelio. Today, we're joined by Matthew Quinn Martin. Matthew is the author of the new Nightlife series, which is out through Simon & Schuster and Pocket Books. You can check out, he's also a screenwriter and an actor as well. Definitely want to get into a little bit of that talk too. And you can check out his website, which is MatthewQuinnMartin.com. And you can follow him on Twitter, which is at Matthew Q Martin. Matthew, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Absolutely.
You know, before we get, because there's lots of, you know, you lead a very interesting life. You've had a lot of different experiences, and, you know, I've got to know each other a little bit through Twitter. And, you know, I want to get into a couple of those things. But before, so we don't skip it, which sometimes we do with our guests, we kind of skip what they were here to really talk about in the first place. Why don't you tell, because you have three books that are out right now. They're part of the Nightlife series. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about that series?
Sure. It's actually, I guess it would be 2.5 books. There's the first book, Nightlife, which follows Jack Jackson and Beth Becker as they sort of team up to hunt these creatures that are plaguing this small city on the Connecticut coast, which may or may not bear a resemblance to New Haven, Connecticut. And then there's the direct sequel to that, which is As the Worm Turns, which follows their narrative. And then there's a related novella that's set in the same universe and has one character in common called Hazardous Material. And all three of those are currently packaged in this sort of limited edition, omnibus edition that Pocket and Simon & Schuster is putting out called Nightlife, Night Terrors. And at the low, low price of only $1.99. So how's that for a plug?
That was great.
Good. We should have you teach everybody how to do book plugs. That was very
Awesome.
So I do have a question before we go too far into stuff, John, and I hope that Matthew will appreciate this. Do you love the nightlife? Do you love to boogie?
I love to boogie. I'm the disco rahound. Absolutely.
Oh, wow. That's very good, Patrick. That's great. All right. Well, you know what?
Contextual music quote.
Yes. Well, you know, but before we get into any more stuff, let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Matthew, why don't you go first then?
I go first? Okay, yeah. My pick of the week is the new Failure album, The Heart is a Monster. If anybody knows this band, then I probably don't need to plug this, but for those of you who don't, this is one of my favorite bands of all time. Their album, Fantastic Planet, is maybe my favorite album of all time. And that came out 19 years ago, and then the band dissolved shortly after that, and then got back together again very recently, and I was lucky enough to see them on tour last year and this year as well. And this new album, The Heart is a Monster, is just sort of better than anything I could have expected, you know, especially after that long of a break for a band to take.
So. Now, if you could sort of give us sort of genre-wise what this band is like, maybe other bands that you think maybe influence them.
The best description I've heard of Failure is your favorite band's favorite band. And they've been called space rock or alt metal. And I know that they were a big influence on Tool and a few other bands that came after them. If you're into stuff like My Bloody Valentine and any of that shoegaze stuff, this would probably appeal to you, as well as if you're into sort of where popular music could have, or I should, well, popular is not the right term, but where rock music could have gone if the grunge movement hadn't been co-opted by you know, corporate rock, and it had been allowed to progress into a more intricate format, I think, you know, with, you know, so it's got some progressive touches and some metal and some space rock. And it's just a really fantastic record and the best one I've heard in a long time.
Cool. So that's Failure. And what's the name of the album again?
The Heart is a Monster.
Cool. I will have to check that out. Patrick, what is your pick this week?
My pick is actually slightly bending our rule.
Oh, okay.
Berkeley Breathed has relaunched Bloom County for 2015.
I'm very excited about that too, actually.
I grew up in a house where my grandmother listened to Larry King every night and read the newspaper every day. And I would sit there with her. And one of the things that she loved was the funnies, as she called them. And so we would sit there and we would go through the comic strips in the newspaper together from a very young age. So I've always been a fan of that medium. And it continued on, and I became a huge fan of Bloom County. I loved Bloom County. I have the collections, you know, that they have. And I didn't really care for Outland or Opus. Though, I mean, they were okay, but they felt like pale versions. And recently, with everything going on in politics, and I had actually joked about this that online, I said that, you know, we're heading back into a Clinton versus Bush election cycle. And are we in the 90s or something? What the hell's going on? You know, it was really, really weird. And it just feels like a throwback. And apparently he feels the same way. And so he's picking up Bloom County almost where it left off and almost ignoring the stuff that was in between. And he's doing a lot with Opus essentially waking up to this new world where it's still Clinton versus Bush. And now Trump is out there and you've got all the characters from Bloom County are back. And it's just wonderful. They even had Cutter John on one, and it's nostalgic for me, but at the same time, it's very poignant and pointedly political at kind of what's going on right now. So I'm enjoying the heck out of it. And I'm just loving to see that he's creating again, and he's doing it currently on his Facebook account. So if you're interested in Bloom County and if you've ever liked the stuff that Berkeley Breathed has done, I recommend you go check that out.
Cool. My pick this week is a TV show, and I can't believe how much I'm enjoying this because I've sort of been looking at it for a long time and I finally got into it. So I'm watching on Netflix, The Tomorrow People, which was, I believe, a CW show from like 2 years ago. It only ran one season.
Yep.
It always came up on my recommendations, and I'm like, yeah, I don't know if that's something for me. And I started watching it because I watched the 100. I watched the first season of that, and I liked that. So I'm like, I'll give this one a shot. And I really like it. I know it's only one season, so there will probably be a letdown by the end. But the reason I'm enjoying it is two things. Number one, it's kind of what we talked about on a past episode recently, where it's a lot of actors that you've seen on other genre shows are sure on this show. So that was part of the thing that got me into it. And right from the first episode in the credits, I'm like, oh, this is a Greg Berlanti show. So if, Patrick and I have talked quite a bit about The Flash and the Arrow TV shows. So this is, I guess he did this while he was starting Arrow. I guess they probably started at about the same time, or maybe like a year after Arrow. So here's how I'll put it. I'm sure, because I remember when the show came out, I sort of remember IO9 and Tor when they would do the write-ups. I don't remember them being particularly kind to the show. However, and I think you, if you want to get really picky about it, I'm sure you can pick lots of stuff apart on this show, but it's, you know, it's special powered people and they can teleport and they have telekinesis and they have telepathy and, you know, so it's sort of X-Men-y and it's like alphas or something. But
Mutant X.
Yes. So
that's a relaunch of an old British TV show, correct? I remember watching that when I was young, on Nickelodeon, I think.
That's interesting, yeah, because I know it was based, they say it's based on it, and I wasn't familiar with the original show that it's based on, but yeah, that's probably it. And here's how I'll put it to you in terms of pitching it and why I'm enjoying it so much. It's like, if you like The Flash and you like Arrow, it's very similar in tone and in structure. So if you like that, And, you know, those shows are not newly running right now. This you got a full 23 episodes of this up on Netflix, and I'm about halfway through it, and I'm digging it. And it's again, it's familiar faces in terms of actors. It's Robbie Amell, who now is Firestorm or half of Firestorm on Flash. It is Peyton List, who is Captain Cold's sister on Flash as well. She was also on Mad Men. And it is Luke Mitchell, who plays, he's on S.H.I.E.L.D., Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. this past season. He's one of the Inhumans, the one with like the electric-y powers. So those are like the three leads. So it's, yeah, it's for summer viewing. It's great. So I really dig it.
And John, I joked with Matthew about everything I know about Long Island before we started recording. Everything I know about Long Island, I learned from How I Met Your Mother.
Uh-huh.
Robbie Amell was actually on How I Met Your Mother at one point. He played a guy that was essentially a dog.
Okay.
Like they all treated him like a dog. Like, and they would throw balls and he would go chase them and he would lick Robin's face and all the stuff. And I just remember that.
That's funny. Matthew, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I just noticed that all three of our picks are in some way reboots of things that are like 20 years old,
exactly,
or older, which is kind of an interesting bit of serendipity.
It is.
Yeah. Cool. It's three totally different things, and great. Cool. All right. Well, let's get on to you know, kind of our main bit here. And you know, Matthew and I have been kind of friendly on Twitter, and I think we kind of met through various author friends, and I feel like it was through some music things. But one of the interesting
music
things
and Beavis and Butthead quotes. I think the one that really nailed. Really caught my attention was when you just tweeted out randomly without any hashtag. I was like, oh yeah, damn it, Pantera, you treat your stepmother with some respect. And it was like, I was in a hospital lobby at the time. My father-in-law was very sick, and that really, really, really made me laugh. I mean, out loud to the point where everybody in the hospital lobby was looking at me like I'd lost my mind.
Well, I'm glad, thank you for that.
Yeah.
Oh, no problem. I'm glad I could bring some levity to you. My wife and I will say that to each other. My wife and I are big Beavis and Butthead fans, so we do a lot of "Damn it, Pantera! You treat your mother with respect."
Well, and every time you do that, John, and then I go into Beavis mode. Fire.
Yeah, when I was on the air the first time around, I used to say it was the litmus test for pseudo intellectualism. If you couldn't admit how funny and how well written that show was because of your prejudice against coming off as dumb for liking it, that was when I knew you were a pseudo intellectual, not an actual intellectual.
I remember. I know it was. Patrick Stewart, that's Jean-Luc Picard, right? That's
yep.
the actor.
Right.
Yep. I saw blank. I almost forgot him. He was, I think he was on David Letterman one time, and Letterman asked him like what he's enjoying, and he went on and on about Beavis and Butthead. He's like, I sit down and I just howl laughing all night long watching. So it's so funny thinking of Patrick Stewart sitting there, but I think that's right to your point, Matthew, that he's an intellectual who likes Beavis and Butthead. So there you go. Only smart people like Beavis and Butthead.
Exactly.
Yeah. But, you know, one of the things that I came across in doing a little bit of research on you is that, you know, in addition to being a novelist, you know, you're also a screenwriter and you have some screenwriting credits, and as well as an actor, and you have some credits on Fringe, the TV series Fringe, and you were in P.S. I Love You, and you said you did a lot of background work in like various TV shows, and you said in a lot of ways sort of being an actor led you to becoming a novelist. So maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit about your acting experience and how that eventually led into your writing.
Sure. Yeah, it was definitely a very roundabout way that I got into writing, and my acting career kind of came in two chunks, and I'm pretty much winding it down now. Although I do still keep my union memberships up and everything, but the first chunk was I was a stage actor. I ran a theater company in New Haven, and I did a lot of stage work and a lot of regional theater, and then. In between acting jobs, I was, you know, sort of extremely frustrated and I needed some sort of creative outlet that, you know, and I thought at the time it was sort of like the, you know, the Matt Damon, Ben Affleck era of like, you know, write your own movie. So that's what I went and did. So I'm going to write a movie and I'm going to star in it. And that movie ended up becoming Slingshot, which I didn't get to star in. But at the time it kind of taught me that, well, you know, like you can't stop someone from writing. You know, if you're an actor and you're trying to be creative, you have to wait to be hired and you have to hope that the part that you're given is somehow creatively fulfilling, and not all of them are, especially if you're doing stage work where you're doing the same performance 8 times a week. And if you're not one of the leads and you're one of the supporting characters, it can be a very, very stifling experience. So that, you know, led me to feel that writing is something that nobody can stop you from doing. You don't have to wait for anybody's permission. You have to, however, though, you know, push yourself to do it. But it felt was a better fit for me. And then the weird thing was, I sort of had this, you know, I quit acting then and focused on writing. And at that point, I was focusing solely on screenwriting, which was going through sort of a change in direction, like as to what people were purchasing, and the spec market was really drying up. Spec scripts, you know, scripts written on out of your mind, and hope that somebody will buy them, and in favor of a lot of these
reboots.
Not reboots, but like anything that has anything. Well, there's that too, but anything that has a pre-awareness factor to it. So whether it's a reboot or whether it's based on a toy or based on a board game or a series of books or whatever, something that's got that can get that can lift it out of the white noise of all the other movies that were being made. Horror seems to be the one exception to this. Horror and comedy seem to be the exceptions to this rule, which of course were not really what I was doing at the time. And so then I guess sort of, you know, when the realization dawned on me that okay, maybe I should try a different tack, and if pre-awareness is what people are after, then maybe creating the pre-awareness with a book might be the way to go. So it was from there that I started focusing on writing novels, which I thought at the time would be, oh, you know, how hard could it be to switch from writing from writing screenplays to writing novels? And of course the answer is incredibly difficult, because they're just different mindsets. With a screenplay, you only have what you see and what you hear, and that's, you know, one of the reasons novels have a difficult time going in that direction is they're used to being able to have a much sort of more complete set of tools to get into the interior life of a character, and with screenwriting you can't really do that, and you have to surrender yourself to the collaborative nature of screenwriting, which also a lot of people who start off writing novels are have a hard time doing. So not all of them, but a lot of them. And so when I started focusing on that, I went to grad school, got my MFA, and just kind of really started heading more and more in that direction. At the time, I needed a job that would allow me enough flexibility to focus on this stuff, go to school, work on the books. So, and I'd been out of acting for years at that point, and that's when I thought, okay, well, you know, I still have my union cards. Maybe I'll give doing background a chance. It seems to be a pretty well-paying job and not particularly demanding. And that was actually how I ended up having this sort of second wind as an actor, was that I was just doing these background jobs, a lot of playing FBI agents and police, you know, it's like detectives and lawyers and all that kind of stuff. And that led to both the part on PS I Love You, where they decided to give us a few lines. Some of the guys who were playing Gerard Butler's friends, I think that was the thing, where it was like his buddies at his funeral. And then Fringe, same thing with Fringe. They hired a group of us to be the main group of FBI agents when they were still shooting in New York, which they only did for the first season. And then they would they had some of us come in and audition for these parts that they had when they needed sort of an FBI agent who had sort of exposition to deliver, but not real characterization. So it was good. It was, you know, interesting that when I'd sort of completely given up on pursuing acting, that's when I got to be on television.
So when they only shot the first season in New York, and then after that they moved to the alternate New York?
Yeah, right. I think the alternate New York is Vancouver. It had all to do with the tax credit system, which at the time was so successful in New York that they ran out of money, and so and they didn't reauthorize the money in time, and a lot of the shows left New York. But since they've since wised up, and a lot of the work is now coming back to New York, or has been for a few years now. I think right now there's more stuff shooting in New York than has ever been the case before.
Isn't it interesting? So I grew up in California, so I get to rag on California whenever I want. isn't it interesting that Hollywood is supposed to be, you know, the center of all of this stuff, and hardly anything is shot there anymore because of tax problems?
Yeah, it is. It's definitely. I mean, also like the machinery of filmmaking is much more portable than it was. Has been for a long, long time. Obviously, that was the beginning of that first wave of independent filmmaking, was when you could start shooting sound on location instead of having to shoot on sound stages and stuff. And now we're seeing you're no longer coupled to film labs carrying on this, you can shoot, you know, films very easily, very inexpensively, and very portably. And that makes it much more enticing to shoot. Instead of trying to fake New York on a back lot or trying to fake Chicago on a back lot, just go to Chicago and make it happen.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and you see, there was like this run for a lot of sci-fi shows where everything was shot in either Vancouver or like Toronto or something like that. Now I'm seeing a lot of things that, like you said, are in New York or Chicago or Georgia. There's a lot of things being shot in Georgia now.
Yeah, Georgia's got huge tax incentives. I know, like, I think American Horror Story, I think, is shot down there, and Salem and True Detective. Yeah, there's a lot going on down there.
A lot of the Marvel stuff is being shot in Georgia.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
I think Archer's even comes out of Georgia.
Yes, Archer
does.
Like
how they do that exactly.
Oh, I love Archer.
Archer's fantastic.
Yeah, so now, so while
Raising.
You were doing... Yeah, so as you were doing...
Raising,
a lot of,
right. Sorry.
It's okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Are we still doing that? Are we still doing
crazy? Right.
If not, what's the new bit?
Said Ripley to the whatever it was. Oh, to the Android Bishop. That was it. Said Ripley to the Android Bishop.
So while you're doing... So it's funny. Yeah, like once you take your focus off acting, that's when you start having success as an actor.
Moderate success, but enough to pay the bills at any rate. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but all through that time, that's when you were really working on your writing. Then.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's just so much downtime. I describe doing background work as like getting paid to sit in the airport. You really do. You'll wait. You have to always be ready to work at a moment's notice. But you'll just sit there in holding for hours, and some people write or work on creative things. Some people just play Sudoku or however that's pronounced, or some people sleep. And so I was always writing, and that was I used to get this a lot, though. People ask me, oh, you know, are you writing a screenplay? I said, no, I'm working on a novel. And then they'd say, oh, is there a part for me in it? And I'd try to explain, it's a novel. And it's like, well, if it gets made into a movie, it's like, yes, you person I've never met before, there's a part for this in you in here somewhere.
Well, then at that point, you say, well, that depends. Is that the last bagel?
Yeah, right.
So, you know, let me, you know, you were saying the differences between screenwriting and novel writing. So is that something that you're aware of in term, you know, or that you think about when you're writing a novel? Like, or is this just a totally separate part of your brain where your novels are your novels and you don't even want to think of them as potentially being a screenplay down the line? Or is that a consideration?
Oh, I think it's a consideration for any writer out there who's, you know, concerned with the success of any project. I mean, a good film or television adaptation or adaptation, I can never figure out which one you're supposed to say, will only serve to help the book itself. And you sort of look at, I think about, you know, Stephen King was, and he'll admit this too, very much helped by the fact that Carrie was such a successful and such a good film, and that his early Stephen King films were quite good. Even if he doesn't like a few of them, they still helped grow his brand more than it would have otherwise. You look at someone like Dean Koontz, who's in my mind equally talented, and has really never had that kind of break, because the films have been disastrous. Or Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child, who I think have only had the one film made, and it was so bad that I think it completely devalued their brand in the mind of a lot of potential readers.
Yeah, it really does make it, you know, and it's funny, as someone who reads
Jack Reacher.
Yeah, Reacher. There you go. Yeah.
It was a terrible book.
Whose book is that based on?
Lee Child.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know, and for me, speaking as someone who reads quite a bit more than the average person probably reads, I still, you know, especially within genre, when I know something is getting made into a movie or a TV show, my interest peaks in it. Like I just like, you know, so I've never read Terry Brooks, but now that's going to be a show. So now I kind of want to check that out because of it. Which I found out that you can read just the second book, cause that's what the series is based on, the Elfstones of Shannara, not the Sword of Shannara. So you can read just the Elfstones if you want to prepare yourself. I asked people about that. But yeah, it does add, I don't want to say a legitimacy, but well, I guess so. You can.
I mean, it's the truth. I mean, as much as we all like to, you know, like it's like that, you know, like it's like that Rush lyric, you know, it's like we all want to believe, but it's, you know, but it's, you know, it's not the case. Where we are working in a commercial art form, and yeah.
Yeah, to some people, like a book doesn't even count unless it's going to be made into a movie or a TV show. Like they won't even consider reading a book that isn't like that.
And it's interesting because you guys were talking about the commercialism and actually, you know, do you think about when you're writing the book about it possibly becoming adapted? And sometimes those fail. And you mentioned Stephen King. My mom, when that show Under the Dome was coming on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She's like, oh, I want to read the book before the show comes on, so, you know, I can be all up on the book and everything. And I said, okay. And so I bought it for her. And she sat down and read this entire book. But in the middle of it...
That's a door stopper.
Yeah, and in the middle of reading the book, the show came on. So she was starting to watch the show and was reading the book. And she finally said to me, she's like, I am so confused. She said, this television show is nothing like the book. And it's not. And Stephen King even told people, he's like, oh yeah, if you're going to watch the show, it's a completely different animal. They've made a lot of changes, and it's not even the same as the book anymore. So you also have that happens, you know, where they, and I've always criticized Hollywood for this. You know, they're going to change it to make it better.
It rarely happens. Occasionally it does. I think, the changes they made to The Mist made it a better film than the novella was. And Silence of the Lambs is one of those rare exceptions where I think the film is superior to the novel. But although the novel is still fantastic. But it is rarely the case that it is improved upon. But the best I think you can hope for is it's equally good in a different way. The Game of Thrones is a good example of that, I think, where the, you know, where they're diverging and they're still both good.
Well, Game of Thrones, they're being forced to diverge.
Yeah, but they'd started to do that before. I think when they still had, obviously some of it's for time, some of it's for the fact that you can't have as big a cast, as big as that cast is, you can't have as big a cast as you can in a novel. And it's certainly not a hugely sprawling novel. And I think that it can, you know, sort of, it can be done where it can be based on, I guess, is what you really need to hold on to. It is based on nothing's ever going to replace the experience of reading a novel. It's just not possible where you create that world. You create that world in your mind, through the agency of the text. and that sort of telepathic experience is not something that can be reproduced in any other medium. At least not yet, anyway. But I think that you can still do a great job. I think, and maybe that's just because having come from a screenwriting background where collaboration is assumed, that you know that things are going to change, and you know that things, that what's in your mind is not what you're going to see. So that flexibility with your creation is something that I think I just carried with me over from there.
So John, here's a question for you. Are you going to pound through The Expanse?
Yeah, good. Yeah, I read the first book. I read Leviathan Wakes a couple years ago. And yeah, I'm going to, so I guess that comes out in December. And from what I understand with The Expanse is that they are going to get beyond book one.
Oh, yeah.
Even in the first season. Like there's going to be some elements or characters at least anyway.
Christian Avasarala. Is going to be in it. Avasarala? I can't pronounce it. But she's in it, and she's a major force in the second book and beyond.
Yeah, so I actually took the second book out of the library. I haven't started it yet, but that's one of those ones where it's a pretty good deal for the ebooks and the audiobook together. I think it ends up being like $15 if you buy them both.
And
so,
I love the audiobooks.
I did too. I listened to the first book as well, so I'm probably going to do that just because that is a pretty lengthy book. That's like a 600-pager, I think. So anytime there's long books, I really do like to have the ebook/audiobook because then I can sort of get through it in a reasonable amount of time rather than spending like 2 months reading Dance of Dragons or something, you know.
And I'm a fan of audiobooks too. I listen to them on the treadmill.
Now, do you do Audible, or do you do like the syncing between the Kindle and the audio? Like, how do you do it typically?
I tried that once, the Whisper Sync, I guess they call it, and I dedicate to one or the other. If I'm gonna listen to a book, I go with a narrator. Again, it adds a layer of interpretation. It's a small one compared to a film. But it is still there. The way that somebody chooses to, you know, certain inflections and stuff will direct your imagination in a certain direction. But at the same time, as somebody who's trying to consume story whenever possible, that 30 minutes in the treadmill is a good time to get it in.
Well, and to your point, that the Expanse books were narrated by Jefferson Mays, all except for one, and that one that he didn't do drove me up a wall.
Yeah, you get used to it. you get used to a certain, especially in a series. I know that both of the J.K. Rowling, the new J.K. Rowling books that she writes under the Robert Galbraith pen name were narrated by the same guy, and it was I couldn't have imagined that having switched.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, and I, you know, I had an experience with that where you know, I talked about him last episode too, but Brian Staveley, who has two books out, I read the first book. I did not listen to it. Second book, I listened and read. And it did take me a while to adjust to the audiobook reader because, to my mind, I interpreted the first book as being the fantasy world, parts of it at least, had a very Asian feel to it, where there's like sort of monks and stuff. So I didn't necessarily picture Asian characters, but that sort of feel was there. And the audiobook reader for book two did a lot of the characters' voices as like a thick Scottish accent. And I'm like, whoa, 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 like a gruff, thick Scottish accent. I'm like, that was not what I would have expected at all. So that did throw me for a while. I eventually adjusted to it. But you're right, it adds that layer of interpretation that once you kind of get going on it, it is a little harder. And I find when I sort of whisper sync between them, I try to listen to a couple chapters before I start reading it, because then when I'm reading it, I sort of have the reader's voice in my head a little bit, because you don't want to get thrown off that way. But that's typically how I work.
And see, that's what threw me in that one book that the other guy did, Eric Davies. Christian Avasarala is a Indian, Hindu Indian, not American Indian. Mm. And so she has that very flair to her voice and accent. And then when the other guy did it, suddenly she's like a Southern Belle.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, what the hell?
The accent choices are weird. I remember when the full cast read of Dune came out, I was very excited to give that a listen. It's one of my favorite books, and I thought, oh yeah, full cast read with sound effects and music. This will be fantastic. And half of the Atreides family had English accents, and the other half didn't. And it was it's very sort of like, okay, pick an accent, but it was like, yeah, I think it was because they'd hired different actors to do it. It just didn't mesh. And yeah, so it can be weird when it sounds like when accents get involved, it can be very difficult or when you're swapping genders, can be very difficult. That's what I thought was cool about the Ender's Game, audiobook was that, they had, and Gone Girl did this too. They had two narrators, a male and a female narrator. So anything that was from the male character's headspace, male narrator did it. And anything from the female character's headspace, the female narrator did it. And it kind of helped.
So are there I'm sorry, John, are there audiobooks versions of your books, Matthew?
Nope, not yet. I am considering doing one of Hazardous Material, though, at some point.
Have you considered doing like a full version with a cast and everything? I've seen people like kickstart that stuff before.
You know, maybe now that you suggested it, I hadn't actually thought of doing that, but yeah, that might be fun.
Now, would you want to do some of the reading yourself? I mean, cause you have an acting background, so.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think so. Or maybe not. I don't know. It's one of those things where it's sort of,
it might be too close for you.
Yeah, maybe. I think with Hazardous Material, I'd like to do that one. Just, you know, I think I could do that. Because it's unlike the other books, you never leave, Jared's headspace, except for these little interstitial bits, which are, you know, these little interchapter bits, which are kind of a technique I lifted from Carrie, where you've got newspaper clip bangs and depositions, sure, and snippets of interviews and stuff like that. I am not ashamed to admit that I steal from writers better than I am all the time. So.
Well, you know, what's the quote? Like, you know, great artists borrow. Oh, no, it's a good artist borrow and great artists steal. So there you go.
Right, there you go, there you go.
And well, I think, like, Frank Miller may have also lifted that because he did that in, like, The Dark Knight Returns.
So you would have little
bits of you're in Bruce Wayne / Batman's head, and then you would have these little bits in between where it's just the news.
Right. That's right. I remember that.
Cool. All right. Well, you know, I think that feels like a nice place to begin to wrap it up. So, really interesting stuff. You know, I'm really delighted. So, thanks for sharing so much about your background. I think that'll be of particular interest to our listeners. And so, once again, it's the Nightlife series of books out through Simon & Schuster and Pocket Books. Now, are those available as print, ebook, and I mean, you know, Patrick asked about the audiobook, but are they both or one of the
just
other?
Ebook? Just ebook. It's right a, yeah, it's a. At some point, hopefully, they'll make their way into print. But that's. But right as it stands right now, it's just ebook.
Okay, very good. So that is the Nightlife series of books. Matthew's website is MatthewQuinnMartin.com, and his Twitter is at MatthewQMartin. When it's all together like that, I'm like, I'm looking.
Yeah,
at
you
Twitter
can't. You're only allowed so many letters on the Twitter handle.
Yeah, so it's at Matthew Q Martin and follow him because he likes he likes a lot of good music, and I see right here on his Twitter page that he annoyed his neighbors by playing the 7/8 part of Tom Sawyer over and over again. So
yes, on bass, but I can only play the bass part. I can't actually sing or play the keyboards with my feet as well.
No.
So.
That's a hard trick to pull off for sure. Yeah. Oh god, we can get into another whole discussion on Rush.
Yeah, yeah. Next time. Yeah. It'll be just rush, all Rush.
Don't start John down the prog rock road.
Yeah. So follow Matthew on Twitter and check out his website and go check out his books too. Anything else you want to tell our listeners about before we wrap it up, Matthew?
Nope. Just in the words of Dr. Buck Rubanzai, remember, no matter where you go, there you are.
Excellent. For me this week, you can just check out some of my new instrumental music over at johnanilio.com. You can follow me on Twitter at johnanilio. And Patrick, what do you have going on this week?
I should be either at Worldcon or just got back from Worldcon, depending on when I drop this episode. So hopefully you either came and saw me and said hello, or you did come and see me and say hello. I don't know. Tense. I'm just not good with tense.
No.
So I can't even, I'm not a camper. So anyway, that stuff, Kirkus, ATFMB, that's me. Find me online. I'm there. You're there.
Cool. All right, Matthew, thank you again for coming on.
Thank you.
And everyone else, we'll have a great week, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Mo.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
Still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?